Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to part two of The French Connection. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith, and this is the Friday edition, 21st day of April 2006. My guest for his third visit in so many months, in fact, about 3 months, is Lieutenant Colonel Barry Turner. He is a retired military officer in the British military. He is now a private citizen. And let me just welcome Barry Turner onto the show here. Barry, are you with me?
Yes, I am indeed.
Well, we've had a few technical problems to get this show underway, Barry, but we're finally moving, and I'm so happy that you're back with us here. You know, we discussed a couple of things today that I thought were very interesting. If you want to reiterate maybe some of our more important things that we talked about today, because there were some things that you were talking about that we hadn't ever discussed before. One of the things that I liked was, you know, talking about, the Jewish participation in the Nazi regime. And the fact was that many of the Jews that lived in Germany had been well integrated, had they not?
Oh, yes, I don't think there's any doubt about that. No doubt about that at all. I think they were, where they were indigenous parts of the society, they were integrated, yes, to a large extent.
Well, I'm talking about real participation within the Weimar, within the military structure, within the bureaucracy, and they remained servants throughout the war in many cases, did they not?
Yes, I don't think there's any doubt about that. A book was written, I think it was about 1940, on the Jews in Britain, and it was simply a dispassionate analysis of who were the Jews and where they fitted into society. And it listed, amongst other things, a large number of Jews in the First World War who'd won decorations, such as one Victoria Cross, numerous Distinguished Service Orders, and military crosses. So there's no question about, the contribution in that sense.
Well, how about in the German military structure? There, what we did find out was that the SS had a contingent of Jewish soldiers, and so did the Luftwaffe. And then within the highest levels of the German government, there was also quite a large German Jewish participation in World War II, and they served throughout the war.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's quite possible. I wouldn't deny it at all. I think one would have to look at this analytically, statistically, to see exactly what the contribution was, what this element of Jewish participation in the German Nazi German structure was, and why. When we have this disparity between that particular situation and, of course, the record of the attempt to get rid of the Jews, either by evacuation abroad or by working them to death or by, starving to death or killing them.
Well, you know, some people have alluded to an agreement that was penned between the leadership of the Nazi Party and Zionist Jews to extricate and then emigrate to the Palestinian region many of the northern and eastern European Jews.
Yes. Oh, there's no doubt about that at all. It certainly went on almost up to the beginning of the war, and it's recorded in official documents because there were translations of British Foreign Office papers and German Foreign Office papers. Well, the British Foreign Office papers are not translated, but the German Foreign Office papers were translated into English, and they were published in a big series of properly bound hardback books listing these documents. I mean, they were published at governmental level, so there's no argument about it. And I remember the English Foreign Office, the British Foreign Office series was published in pale blue, grey-blue linen board covers, and the Germans in a sort of pale pink. And you can find in there a very positive record of this collaboration.
Well, now, here's the interesting thing, because we know that the Balfour documents in 1917 kind of set the stage for this. Where's the link between what action was taken in Poland and in Germany and parts of other countries such as Czechoslovakia and the forced immigration to Israel? I mean, there has to be a link between the Balfour signing and the rest of it, because we know that the leadership of the Zionist groups that were forcing Palestine to accept these people wanted this from the very beginning, and I think that much of what happened in regards to Jewish subjugation during the war was for the very reason of getting them to leave and go to Palestine.
Yeah, well, the move is said to have originated with Moses Hess, the Jewish communist in the middle of the 19th century, and the Rothschild family, certain elements of the Rothschild family, at the end of the 19th century, were specifically organizing the movement of Jews to Palestine, to the Middle East. I mean, it was a sort of wide open space, as it were, arguably, at that time. But there was no question that this was being done. The Balfour letter is said, and again, we cover such a wide history. Anybody picking this up needs to do their own research and satisfy themselves. But it is said that Chaim Weizmann bargained with the British government in exchange for support of the chemical industry. I'm not quite sure of the details, but that's on record.
Yeah,
it is also said that a Rothschild, member of the Rothschild family, drafted or helped draft the letter. But the one thing that's missing, of course, throughout this sequel to the present day, is that the second part of that letter made it quite clear that the settlement of Israel, indicating a spiritual home, a national home, not a state, that should take place, or could take place, without prejudice to the existing population. Now, that's very convenient to have forgotten.
Yeah, well, and in fact, that was started, they undermined that whole thing even in advance of the 1948 statehood declaration. They were already doing that back in the 30s before the war, weren't they?
Yes. Yes, I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, from the Palestinian point of view, the Arab point of view, they knew perfectly well what was going on, and there were numerous sort of inquiries and commissions and quite a lot of insurrection. It was only to be expected. It was of course, during the war and shortly afterwards that the organized Zionist resistance, the terrorism, the beginning of the term terrorism, I suppose, was instituted in Palestine. And, of course, they murdered people like Count Bernadotte and killed and tortured a number of British servicemen.
Well, we know that that this conspiracy to establish that region under their control has a larger agenda. And, in fact, where we are today is at the very tail end of their plans, and it includes the consolidation of both Iraq and Iran under their watchful control, and they're using the power of the British government as well as the American government to get much of this done, aren't they?
Well, I don't think there's, again, it's a very wide subject, and I don't think one can afford to make sweeping statements, but there is no doubt at all. It's identifiable by name, statistically, organizationally, that there is a very strong presence which is working, shall we say, primarily in the interest of Israel. To me, this is the most odious element, one of the most odious elements of this situation, is a dual loyalty. And people within a country, a nation, owe their loyalty, if they're going to live and take advantage of the circumstances of that nation, they owe a primary loyalty, a singular loyalty to that nation. And this is the great problem. It's more subtle in Europe and the United Kingdom. It's open in the United States and is openly referred to.
Mm-hmm.
And until this problem is cracked, nothing is going to be resolved in the Middle East, because everybody knows it. It's denied, it's glossed over by the control media, and of course you only need a number of individuals who have this dual loyalty, active dual loyalty, to be in key positions in the media, in politics, in various other fields, academia, yeah. to inhibit a proper examination of this problem. But
well, they have done that, and that's exactly what you and I discussed this afternoon. And when I said how many people do you think they need, you came back with something that kind of surprised me. You said very, very small numbers. It doesn't take a large number of people because if they're in the key positions and they have I think you used the stick they can use is calling people anti-Semitic.
Well,
if you challenge them, they don't really have to have a large group of people to knock you down, do they?
No. Well, this has happened. This happened to me locally,
mm-hmm.
And there's no question about why it was done. And I have been very careful to keep a very open mind. What I believe is we must look at everything in a very fluid and changing, evolving situation.
Yep.
And you cannot blame any one faction or race or creed or culture.
That's right.
In this scenario. But
mm-hmm.
In one local paper, I was carrying on quite an interesting sort of correspondence in the letter columns on communism, the communist system, its power and influence, and on the financial system, the banking system. Now, in that correspondence, there was no reference whatsoever to anything that could have been considered anti-Semitism, should we say, or any allusion to the Jewish influence. None whatsoever. Now, in the other local paper, a letter appeared, obviously from somebody with a Jewish provenance, advocating school leavers at the end of their time in senior school
mm-hmm.
should spend time on a kibbutz in Israel. Now, it was a perfectly reasonable letter. I wrote back and pointed out that, the Palestinians were oppressed, the Sabra Shatila massacre, of course, was still topical, and the treatment of the Palestinians, and I had a sheaf of UNRWA reports, and I was also very much involved with the founders of Medical Aid for Palestinians,
yeah.
who had friends in, shall we say, both camps.
Yeah.
Now, the originator of that letter came straight back with an attack on what I said. I responded, and in equal length, and the editor, bless him, published all our letters, I think, without any amendment, and I put him in his place, and that seemed to end the matter. Shall we say an honorable draw?
Uh-huh, but, okay.
Now, that was in the second paper I mentioned. In the first paper, where I was carrying on a correspondence on the communist system and so on and so forth,
yeah.
there was also a hot debate going on, a very, very angry debate, over blood sports, the English hunting scene. Now, somebody wrote in who was very anti-blood sports, and they said, en passant, with no reason whatsoever, just like Colonel Turner and his notorious anti-Semitism. Now, that was wholly unjustified. It was certainly patently not true. Now, clearly, somebody had picked up this anti-Semitic ball and run with it, and it's very
yeah.
damaging. It didn't take a huge movement. It didn't take a large number of people. It just wanted one person to twist the knife. And the newspaper, of course, were hugely apologetic about this. And they did say that if I published my rebuttal, they would publish it. Unfortunately, what they didn't do was box it in bold type when an important letter is featured in the letter pages, the letter columns, which they had been perfectly able to do. It was, my letter was embodied in the sort of, you know, the whole page of letters with no particular importance, no particular highlighting. Now, I fell out with the newspaper in a big way, and it got to sort of solicitors on both sides. But you see, the point was, I don't think that the newspaper realized how this anti-Semitic weapon was wielded. And
that's
it was
right.
used in my case because I spoke up for the Palestinians. There was no other evidence to go on.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing. They've used it against me. They called me a Holocaust revisionist and denier. And I have made it very plain on this program that I don't touch the Holocaust issue as a research interest. I don't speak about numbers. I don't speak about whether I think it's a factual thing or not, because of course, you know, I live in a hate crimes country, so
yeah.
rather than touch that issue, I don't touch it. Of course, they have said that I'm a Holocaust revisionist. They said I'm a Holocaust denier. Never have been, never said a word about denial or revision. And so, of course, anybody who reads this, you know, they've been trained like a, almost like a Pavlovian response to anything that comes out in this way, and immediately they're going to broad brush me as an anti-Semite.
Well, go on.
Well, my point being is, this is a very structured and very organized conspiracy. Go ahead.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, my experience is quite sufficient. Of course, one can't tar everybody with the same brush. There's another, I think, total misrepresentation. Those who are genuine sort of conspiracy nuts, they may be well informed, they may have done a lot of research and so on and so forth. There is a tendency to say, oh, well, the Jews get somebody on each side. Now, this is absolute cobblers. I mean, no community, no culture is homogeneous. You're going to have people of opposing, genuinely opposing views. And, you know, it's a natural order of things. And you cannot blame Jews for this. But one thing is quite clear. A certain element of the militant Zionists, the political Zionists, and the network which draws their loyalty or enforces the loyalty, is active. Now, Igor Vidal, in a foreword to a book by the late Professor Israel Shehak, who wrote from Israel as an academic, Israeli academic, called 3000, it was Jewish History, Jewish Religion. Very critical book and a fascinating book. Now, Gore Vidal wrote in the and that's another Jew writing, in the foreword that, I forget how he put it, I haven't got it to hand because I'm not sitting at my telephone with all the papers, but he said something like the organized Jewry in America control no less than 72 United States senators.
Yes.
Something of that order. In other words, he was very specific. And if you read J.J. Goldberg's book, another Jewish author, he writes very credibly about this power. But of course, he doesn't define it as monolithic. There are certain elements that are powerful, but of course, they do hold a huge... they do exercise a huge hold, a very powerful hold, over the community as a whole.
Well, do you know how they've done this? And Eric and I have done a great deal of research on how they've done this. Much of it is compromising them through catching them doing either criminal acts or sexual deviancy, and then either recording it or you know, qualifying it in some kind of way where they can hold it over the head of these people. And what we also understood was that they don't start promoting you as a politician unless they've got the compromise already in place.
Oh, this is the sort of tactics one would expect, because the what is used, of course, is a tactic of ad hominem attack. In other words, you attack the individual, not the evidence. You see, anybody who becomes involved in this particular debate is destroyed. The evidence never gets, to court to open debate. The individual is challenged and destroyed and discredited.
Well, my point, Barry, was that, you know, especially when you spoke about the 72 senators, we only have 100 of them. How do they keep these people in tow? How do they keep them in control? And my thought to you is this: what we understand now is many of these senators from early in their career were selected for their ability to be controlled through compromise, by being caught with a child, or by being caught with embezzling, or being caught something very negative that they can be held to account for. And when it comes time for elections, their campaign gets financial support, and whoever runs against them is savaged. And what it does is it keeps their compromised candidate in their control.
But in a sense, you know, I haven't got a great deal of sympathy with people who leave themselves open to be caught. I wouldn't want them representing me either. But the point is, enormous sums of money, and this is, again, quite openly written about by people like J.J. Goldberg and others, huge sums of money are channeled in support of candidates they want in power. It's a different side of the same coin, as it were.
Yeah.
Now, if you take Paul Finlay, they dare to speak out. I mean, Finlay went to Aden. I think we've discussed this before. Finlay went to Aden because one of his electorate was in some trouble in Aden, I think it was. Anyway, he went out there. And as somebody not knowing very much about the Middle East and its history and its politics at all, he learned a great deal from the Arab population in Aden.
Yes.
And, of course, when he started to make noises, they went for him and got rid of him.
Yes,
and if you look at it from this point of view, I mean, this is no democracy. It's a small element. And it exists, there's no doubt at all.
Well, how do we defeat them? I mean, before we got on air today, Barry, I talked to my listeners. I said, you know, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir because you know the story. You know the conspiracy. I said, you tune in to get color on some of the issues, but basically we've exposed the entire story. And so did Ben Friedman in 1961, and really he never got traction. And so did others back in the 1950s. The communist conspiracy was exposed by McCarthy and so on. And the fact is, are we going to die the same death of not ever getting traction? And so that's the question that I asked them. And so I'm going to ask you, how do we not end up suffering the silencing that Ben Friedman went under?
Well, it's a process of education and public concern, and it's very hard to get across. What we have to remember is that in our two countries, and without speaking for Europe, France and Germany, principally, our two countries, we have two main political parties with damn little difference between them.
That's right.
And you will not get past these parties because in key positions in all these parties, you have people of this disposition.
Yeah.
And it is very difficult to get the message across. There are plenty of books being written, perfectly respectable, analytical books have been written about this situation. They won't get reviewed in the mainstream press, which is controlled by the same people.
Yes, right.
And you have this enormous problem. An interesting situation has developed in the UK, where the British National Party I'm sidetracking slightly. The British National Party has always been regarded as extreme right-wing, neo-fascist, any cachet you care to award it, because it is nationally oriented. It is a loyalist party. It is against massive immigration. Mm-hmm. Now, the present Labour Party, which is really an international socialist organism these days, it's international, which is why national cultures and so on are dissolving under his regime, has ignored the problems expressed by poor white Brits, and you can include a large part of the long-term coloured population in that. One doesn't really make a distinction, but certainly the hardcore of ordinary people in urban areas have been persistently ignored, their problems, their economics and so on and so forth. And suddenly there's a great scare. They're turning to the British National Party. And immediately the establishment press and the establishment spokesman, the talking heads, of course, wade in with this extreme right neo-fascist cachet. And Lord Tebbit, no less, a hard-line traditional conservative, wrote in the Daily Telegraph today about what the British National Party stands for. It stands for the national culture, the national identity, sensible restrictions on immigration, the economic lot of ordinary people. And he's saying,
right.
Well, this is more left-wing than right-wing.
Mm-hmm.
And you're into another area where this left-wing, right-wing thing is a load of cobblers. They're meaningless terms attributed
to a potential enemy.
But we have our parties elected, And this is the problem you face until the public, in the guise of the poorer working class, suddenly begin to rise up and send a shiver through the existing party, the Labour Party in this case. And they spotted it, possibly too late. You're talking about local elections at the moment, because the general election, of course, you have far greater constraints on the minority parties. And right. The establishment press will, and you're talking about a lot of hacks who really are as ignorant as the public to a large extent. They're merely earning their job pushing a typewriter key. But they will line up ritually on the same lines. So you will rarely get through this barrier.
Well, there have been your relationship over the years with our dear friend Felicity. She's never been able to, get a full story aired on any of the main issues, on any of the press. And she's been writing some of the best stuff Britain's ever known. And the fact is, when she does have a new venue now, but there is a move afoot to start looking at some of the research that internet sites like mine are doing, because the facts are, we are exposing the truth here, and I think some of this mainstream press are starting to fear the effects of this internet.
Yes, they will only go so far and no further, though, it's a very difficult situation. We just have to keep wearing away at it. Some cracks are certainly showing, that's true, and Felicity is getting more outlets than she did hitherto. But
yeah.
She tends to be heard in what they like to call the left-wing press. But I've had many conversations with Felicity on the Middle East and society in general.
Yeah.
And we are not, I suppose one might say, I started from a far, far further to the right position, a more conservative position, and Felicity traditionally the anti-nuclear movement towards the left. But in fact, when we talk, and we've been talking for 6 or so years now, we're really talking about right and wrong, truth and falsehood.
Not right and left, and wrong.
No, that's right. And this is what it boils down to. But I'll give you another one. There was an interesting double-page feature in The Guardian Weekly. Now, The Guardian, you call, a traditional Labour-leaning paper, left-leaning paper. The Guardian had a two-page feature on the battle on the American campus.
Okay.
It featured around the University College of, I think it's California, Los Angeles. And there, what they are reporting is enormous pressure, and this obviously goes across the whole of the university structure in America. They're reporting the pressure put on any academic who steps out of line on the Middle East. And, of course, they're condemned as left-wing again. And you meet, there's a man called Horowitz. Well, he's no Scotsman, judging by his name. And this is where you get more. You get Alan Dershowitz. And he attacks even Professor Noam Chomsky. I know we differ slightly on Chomsky, but I have a huge respect for Professor Noam Chomsky. I think he's a man of outstanding courage and integrity who's gone much further than most on the global stage and in the Middle East.
Well, I happen to like Norman Finkelstein is the guy that I...
Yes.
He's tough, man. He just says it like it is. Norman does.
Well, he needs to be. And, of course, he has exposed to a degree the Holocaust. Or the Holocaust industry. I mean,
industry.
Nobody wants to deny the Holocaust as such.
Yeah.
But the Holocaust industry is holding everybody to ransom. It's one area where no discussion whatsoever is permitted.
Yep.
And, of course, a whole ramp of these fringe subjects on the fringe of that, which sort of hinge on it, if you like, hinge on the Middle East, hinge on Israel, are tied to the present situation in the Middle East.
Well, you know something, Barry, when I take a look at where we are today and how we can get this thing out into the mainstream, I guess what we're going to do and the only thing we can do is do it one person at a time. I mean, it's got to be grassroots or it's not going to work.
Well,
so
yes.
What I've asked for and what I'll ask right now, I mean, share these files. I mean, you and I have become acquainted through a mutual friend, and this is how this works. I mean, we move through, these facts And what we try to do is share them with people that we think are willing to take a stand with us. And
yes.
But the sad thing is, Barry, very few people today are willing to.
Well, of course, in the West generally, it's a fairly prosperous society, which is why those nations were exploited over a couple of centuries, three centuries perhaps, and more, are moving this way for a better life. We are largely, materially, reasonably well off. You have extremes between wealth and poverty, this is very true. But relatively speaking to, the third world, we've nothing to worry about. It until you get people either starving on the streets, and of course I mentioned the British National Party and the situation of the poor populations in the urban areas, with special reference to the white population,
yeah,
the original inhabitants, you're not going to get any reaction. People have got to put their golf clubs away, they've got to switch their bloody television sets off and get with it. And I believe the local government level in this country, and I'm sure it has a translation in the United States, at the local government level, people have got to get switched on to the economic realities, the political realities, and they have got to make their elected representative damn well work for them. Instead of paying homage to your local member of parliament or senator or congressman, you summon them and tell them what they damn well will do in the interest of the people who elect them. But it's a big bridge to cross.
Yes.
I think a lot will hinge on the local, or should hinge on local radio, in your case probably local television stations,
mm-hmm,
and the local press. That is where I suspect there is a good deal less central ownership and control.
What we're doing here, see, I got to be honest with you, our audience is from South Africa, from Australia, from Canada. We've got people from Czech Republic listening. Moscow, I got several listeners from Russia. We are truly an international broadcast, and people have come to our information from every walk of life. And I got to be honest with you again, I don't think that we can stop on a national level, because this conspiracy does not know any borders.
Well, this is true. It depends how you identify the conspiracy as a monolithic entity, one which has a single point control and so on and so forth, or a sort of massive tidal movement of different elements that come together. But we certainly have to be aware of it. I think we have to keep a very open mind. We have to be as fair-minded as possible. We must avoid all prejudice. But we must be realistic. And when there is truth, we must identify it, examine it, and try to explain it. One doesn't go shooting off about various races, cultures, creeds, or nations. One has to look at everything very carefully. It's a fluid situation. And as I say, one has to maintain a sense of balance. But it's a huge problem just for any one individual study.
Well, I've looked into a couple of groups that I mentioned to you today. One of them was the Shabbat Lubavitch.
Yes.
And you didn't know a whole lot about the Lubavitchers. However, they are present in all major cities in Britain, as well as every major city in America. And they are the fastest growing segment of this Zionist conspiracy that we've uncovered. And in fact, it was the reason why I was taken off my other network. I mentioned the Shabbat Lubavitch, and within just a day or two after that, I was gone.
Yeah, you again, there are different factions, just as there are in any culture, any religion, and quite often very hostile factions opposed to each other's interpretations within that religion.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, Churchill writing, and no less than Winston Churchill, I mean, you know, how more credible can you get in modern history? Churchill writing, and I think it was 1922, in the Illustrated London Herald, wrote about the international Jew, and he was very careful to discriminate between the ordinary, peaceful Jew who just happened to be a Jew with his own religion, his or her own religion, and an organized, coherent power of a small minority as an organ. Now, Churchill wrote that, so writing that, he must have known it, he must have identified it.
Yes.
And I think we have to accept that. The Soviet Military Encyclopedia of 1979, that was it was the only time, I'm told, that the Soviet Military Encyclopedia ever came to the West. I think the Soviet Union in 1979 allowed about, I was told, three sets. It's in about eight volumes to be released to the West. And a translation of that on Zionism makes it very clear the central core of this power structure. Of course, it's not the only power structure. It's not the only one.
Right.
The Soviet, of course, Soviet military, the politico-military doctrine, embraced a very, very detailed and very careful analysis from, you know, the history from the French Revolution, shall we say, onwards.
Yes.
That set of books is a study in its own right. But they were meticulous, and they drew on history, they drew on foreign sources. It's not just communist ramblings. The other thing I think is worth looking at as an example, when I was in South Africa, Dr. Ambrosini, I may have mentioned this last time, but, you know, mm-hmm. one has to apologize if one sort of...
Oh, don't worry.
Dr. Mario Ambrosini, who was an Italian-American constitutional lawyer, mm-hmm. advising Dr. Buttiglione of the Inkatha Freedom Party,
yes.
Had been involved in a lot of political diplomatic negotiations. I mean, that was his forte. He wasn't a front man. And he pointed out to me, in terms of looking at interpretations, conspiracies, power blocks, he said it's rather like peeling the layers of an onion.
Yes.
You have one impression at one point, and as you peel the layers away, you find different interpretations, different combinations of interests, vested interests, and so on. You know, the power play varies. The level of the power play and so on, depending on how far you penetrate that onion.
Well, that's an interesting analogy, and I got to say that where we have come to, we know that there are goals of these people, and one of them is a consolidated power base within the Middle East, and we can see that through their actions. And they, what's the saying? You will know them through their actions, right?
Well,
people's word. Mean nothing. What we need to do is take a look at how it is they manifest themselves. And this Israel that is present day, shooting 400 rockets into the Gaza Strip in a single weekend of this past weekend, and then at the same time we're in a war in Iraq, committing genocide on their behalf, and almost poised to go into Iran.
Well, of course, we. Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
We have a lot of prating about introducing democratic values to people who may or not wish them. It may or may not suit their culture. This nonsense about democratic values when we have none in the West, in either side of the Atlantic, when in this country and in America, two very similar major parties are competing for the vote. Democracy is meaningless because what they do when in power, having got the vote, is a totally different thing as often as not.
The Greeks already knew, and I've talked about this before, if you studied Kyklos cycles, They talk about the necessity of democracy turning to tyranny, and in fact the only form of government that has ever been any hedge against tyrannical leadership it's been a constitutional republic, and a constitutional republic that guarantees certain levels of minimum levels of control and lack of control over the public. And the fact is, our constitutional republic in the United States has been dismantled.
Well, yes. I mean, to a degree, it's more subtle here. And it's done in a very peaceful way. There's no bloodletting significantly. It's done very peacefully through the political processes. But it amounts to the same thing. But to introduce democracy to foreign countries, especially where they have huge oil deposits, for example, is a load of rubbish. I mean, it is introducing governments that can be controlled and displacing governments or dictators like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who stand up to be counted and won't be integrated in the global economy. And again, you have this situation. We've covered this, I'm sure, before in the case of Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was an independent communist state. which was independent economically of the global economy, and it had to be brought into the mosaic of Europe in that case. But if you look at the layers of the onion, what the United States, because it simply has the sheer muscle at the moment in the shadow of China, I might say, this is becoming very clear very rapidly, but the United States is simply colonizing the world just as Great Britain and Europe did, European powers, in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. It's no different. And it's where you have the power, you grab, and it's as simple as that. It's an American empire based on the dollar and an exploding multi-trillion debt, which is sooner or later going to come apart as it seems. It has to. But you see, if you peel the layer of the onion a bit further back, it means in the Middle East and in India, for example, huge profits for Monsanto.
Yeah.
It means huge profits for Halliburton. Now, that's a much shorter term look at things, and those companies are paying their shareholders, and they are committed to their shareholders. They must be. But you see, this is where their position is when you peel away the layers of the onion. It's very different to these great proclamations about bringing democracy.
Well, you know, what I also know, and we're gonna use this as our last maybe response on this particular broadcast. But here's the interesting thing, Barry. We know the same bankers were behind the British Empire that are behind the American Empire.
The continuity and of banking.
That's right. And we know the same people have always been behind the French. In fact, they were backed the French against the British, and they were backing both sides of the war. We also know that they were behind the implosion of the Russian government. And so, but my point being is that all the empires that we've ever seen in the world's history, the money people, the financiers of these empires have been the same people. And they're the same people behind America. And when they're ready to pull the rug out from America, they will go to another place and set up empire there again. And it will fleece the world, and they will do it for their own means. And here's the interesting thing. I think this time, because of technology, because of advancements, it's going to be a global world that we live in, a global governance with, with these people sitting in the catbird seat, and we're going to be down below prey animals. And I don't want this for my kids. I don't want it for my grandkids. And I'm wondering, as a going out statement here, how do you feel?
Well, I think it's absolutely right. I think the situation does exist. It is evolving all the time. And there is a huge presence, influence within the banking system. You've only got to look at the names. A very interesting debate was featured at the Jewish Book Fair recently between Jack Attali, the European banker, and Professor Eric Hobsbawm, the communist, the Marxist academic in this country. And it is very interesting. It has no, I would say, racial connotation other than the people taking part and where it took part. But it's a very impartial look at Karl Marx and what he really predicted and what is coming to pass today.
Yeah.
And you don't put a racial, as I say, label on it. It is the situation as it is. The New Statesman, it's a fascinating article. But my last comment would be one I mentioned to you earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The way populations are being controlled, and through political correctness and political measures, political legislation, we are losing our independence of thought, action, culture, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And the one philosopher who I've forgotten his name now, and I've got his a great British philosopher related to the Duke of Bedford family. He wrote that under this process, a challenge of the plebs against the masters would be as unthinkable as the practice or an insurrection of sheep against the practice of eating mutton. And I think this sums it up.
Well, it does sum it up, and you know something.
Sorry, I forgot your name. It just slipped.
Well, we're gonna find it out and put it on the website. But Barry, you know something.
I mentioned it to you. You haven't remembered it either.
you know something, Barry. I've got a memory like a steel trap, except when it doesn't work.
Yeah.
and I tell you something. You know something.
I think the point is important, though.
Well, it is important. Every
Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell was a philosopher.
Bertrand Russell,
world famous philosopher. It was he who wrote in a book in about 1958. It's come back. Yeah.
Well, you know, we got a famous philosopher in New York City called Yogi Berra, and he said, "It ain't over till it's over," and that was his input to the world. And I got to tell you, I've got to go with Yogi on this one.
I think he and Bertrand Russell should have met. It could have been interesting.
because you know something, I'm not giving up until my last breath is taken from me. And boy, oh boy, I hope we get more traction than Ben Friedman did in his lifetime. And it's time for us to merely take a stand as human beings. I want to thank you again, Barry. You always add very great color to all of our work that we do here at the French Connection. And it's an honor to know you, my friend.
Well, it's very kind of you to have me on the program. I hope I've made myself useful to a degree at least.
Well, you have. You always do. And I want to thank you again. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Barry Turner, a colonel, retired, lieutenant colonel, retired from the British military.
Colonel, actually.
Colonel. Okay,
yeah.
Full bird colonel.
Yeah, I got on my knees for a bit longer, you see.
Well, you know, to having been a colonel in the military, and now he's fighting for the values that he believes in and that we share here on this French Connection broadcast. So, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all for tuning into this Friday show. It is a political movement that we're in, so that means you need to go out and recruit new people to this party that we're setting up here, this movement worldwide. But until the next broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, this is the end of our week, and we will talk to you next week. Be well.